I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and I'm really impressed with the way that the programme of today has been constructed to let us go from one area to another, and everything's feeling as though it's flowing really well. So I hope that the points that I seek to make in the next half hour will clearly build on, reflect on the points that we've already had highlighted today, and present them in a different context and different ways of explaining them. So I want to talk not so much about risk as about what I've come to call the contested territories of everyday life. I'm going to start off by talking about a specific project, specific research project, but go on to, if we have time, just take a moment to tackle that really difficult issue that all of us in practice or as family members or as people with dementia face in terms of how to manage really complex decision making around what's okay, what's not okay, do we not, such complicated decision making that we all have to engage with. And I'm going to start off talking about this particular project that was all about how people with dementia, their families and practitioners construct, understand, manage risk. And it was a study I took forward with long-term collaborators, John Keady and Heather Wilkinson, and some fantastic staff on the project as well. And again, I'm gonna just kind of like put this out wide to start with and then come down. So just by way of context, we haven't actually mentioned the kind of how big an issue is this dementia thing that we're talking about. I'm not going to labor these points, you're probably well aware. But the Wellcome Trust going, this is the most significant health crisis, however you wish to describe it, to the 21st century. And at last, the World Health Organization coming in and saying it's a key public health concern. And for us to position dementia as a public health concern, I think is something that's a very significant step we need to take forward. So let's move from that big picture of how dementia is impacting on the world to think about something that is so important to all of us, and that's about home. And what does home mean for us? And if you look in a dictionary or think yourselves about what home means to you, it generally spins around being somewhere that is a non-threatening place to be, with has routines that feel very familiar and habitual to us, and where we don't have any surveillance, we're not checked up on, we haven't got the boss at work emailing saying, oh, I saw you left work 10 minutes early yesterday, would you like to explain that, you know? But what happens when the home has dementia suddenly present with it in it? And I'm using dementia as this kind of out there term, not the person. But suddenly you maybe have homes, and we have millions of homes across the globe, in which dementia is suddenly present. And Janet Ascombe did a lovely study where she talked about there is a chance, a risk, of adopting the characteristics of total institution. And harping back to Goffman's work, I want to set this as a bit of a context. And what Goffman talked about around total institutions was three core characteristics: mortification of the self, diminution of somebody's sense of identity, purpose, and meaning, routinization of activities, care, and high levels of surveillance. So everything that our own homes are perhaps not supposed to be. And there's been some very interesting work around the carer, the family member, being a mediator between private experiences and public services. And we've heard already today about, you know, our home being our own place and does not normally have health, social care practitioners going in and out of it and things. So that notion of our private home space starts to break down when there's suddenly dementia in there and perhaps also health, social care practitioners' services in there as well. So what we did in this study was, it was had several phases to it, but I'm going to concentrate on one phase. We interviewed 55 people who had had a diagnosis of dementia on up to two occasions. That makes it a relatively large data set of its type, actually. Those people with dementia nominated a family member and a professional carer who they invited us to talk to as well. So each of those 55 instances, if you like, probably had around four interviews around each. Tried to get a spread across people living independently with some service support, maybe daycare, and in residential care. And across three areas in the UK, so Northeast England, the Lothian area of Scotland, and North Wales. So quite a geographical spread. We came at it by way of trying to understand the kind of case studies of those three triadic elements of the person with the diagnosis of dementia, a family member and a professional carer, paid carer. And what came out of that analysis was this notion that we call contested territories. And what I want to explore here a little bit is what some of those contested territories were and what their symbolic meanings and practical manifestations were. Now, we clustered those around five perfectly ordinary, everyday things: friendship, smoking, going out, domestic arrangements, and occupation and activity. We are not saying those are the only five territories in which there are sometimes contested positions. And I don't want to kind of be drawing on the whole 55 plus sample. So I just want to anchor this, make it feel like these are the people. So I've taken four of the people with dementia who were in the sample just to use as case examples, if you like. So Margaret was relatively young. She was in her 60s, lived alone. She nominated her daughter and her occupational therapist for us to talk with. Martin lived in Scotland in his 80s. Sorry, Martin was in Wales. He nominated that we talk to his wife, Jane, and a community practitioner. He lived in a very remote area, and that's significant when it comes to issues around driving. Jack lived in Scotland in his late 70s, lived with his wife, who also had health problems, and he nominated Kath, his wife, and their community psychiatric nurse for us to talk to. And Mary, who lives with her partner in the northeast of England. So we spoke to Peter, her partner, and the daycare staff that she had in her life as well. So let's just take this issue of friendship to start with. And what does friendship actually bring to people? For a start, the people we spoke to talked about how it's through friendship that they could make sense of the situation they were in. So Mary talked about being in the day centre and being able to all have a laugh. And Peter, her partner, talked about it being a way in which having friendships was a way in which she realised she wasn't alone anymore. They also talked about it as a way in which they maintain identity. It's through that relationship with other people, through friendships, that people were using ways of maintaining their identity. So Mary said, I feel human, as opposed to it's always, and she's talking about her interaction with her partner Peter in their own home, now don't do this and don't do that or you'll not like that. So when she's with her friends, it's when she felt human. Friendships were also activities that were very supporting to people. Martin was a great organizer. He had a large group of friends, used to be going out on holiday with people. He'd be the organizer of this big friendship group. And he talked about how they were always on the lookout for him. And he perceived that as a very supportive thing. But people also talked a lot about the contraction of friendships. And Jane spoke about her husband's dementia and saying in relation to their friends, it takes so long to tell his stories. I think some people get a bit bored and a bit intolerant of it. Let's look at smoking as another contested territory. So here's Mary talking about the paradox that she experienced. She smoked, she'd had a stroke and and developed dementia. So people, she was used to the smoking being blamed for her position, her situation. So she's saying here, other people would say, well, you shouldn't smoke. And then she's asserting, but it's the only pleasure I've got. It calms me down. So a real paradox here. The one thing that people, everybody else is telling her has led her to be in the position she's in. But actually for her, it's also something that she sees as offering pleasure in her life and something that's a strategy for her calming herself down, as she says. But it's also part of social life. So she talks about when she goes to the day centre, she says there's four of us who go outside for a cigarette. I can have a cigarette and discuss things. So for her, friendships, social networks span around the activity of smoking. But for her partner, Peter, it was also a source of considerable concern. And he actually got up during the interview and went and got a dressing gown to hold it up and show all the burn holes in it. And, you know, she said she's burning her jumpers, her dressing gown, it's full of holes. And because of that, he'd moved into high surveillance mode, checking on her all the time. So a real tension within their relationship that was causing. The third key area, contested territory, I've called it domestic arrangements. It's things like who gets to do the washing up and the drying up and putting away the dishes. So here's Mary again. She says, I put them, the dishes, back all in the wrong places. So he, Peter, has to sort that out. Will you please leave that alone, he says, and I feel like I'm not wanted. So she's now excluded from the kitchen. She gets told to go and sit down and have a rest while he does the washing up and the drying up and puts the dishes away. Very malignant positioning, I can imagine you're beginning to think to yourselves. Margaret, the lady who lives on her own, talked about how she used to love cooking. She said, now I can't. I live out of packets. It's hard to give up the things up. The cupboard's still full of cooking things. And actually, I gave a seminar a little while ago and included some of this material. And there was a lady who came up to me afterwards and said, do you know, I was planning this weekend to go and clear out my mum's kitchen because she's got all this stuff she doesn't use anymore. So I was going to get rid of it. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to leave it there because she maybe doesn't use the baking tins. She maybe doesn't use the saucepans, but she's spent her whole life cooking. And actually, these things are really important for her sense of identity, is to be surrounded by the artifacts of cooking and things. And Kath talked about a slightly different situation. Talked about a point at which they had discovered that quite a lot of debt had been racked up, and what a shock that was to the system for that couple. So there was something about relinquishing responsibilities and also taking responsibilities. So responsibilities being moved around in the context of domestic arrangements. Who's managing the money? Who's doing the dishes? Who's doing the cooking? What does that look like? And Peter also talking about domestic arrangements in terms of this notion of surveillance. And he said this in the interview, the problem now is watching, wondering what she's doing now, mislaying things, a source of considerable anxiety to him. And then looking at occupation and activity and some of the contestation that sits around this. Margaret had had a career as a nurse and had had to give that up because she had had a bad back. And she then went on to be a librarian and had had to give that up because she then, because of her dementia, couldn't quite figure out always where the books were to go. She couldn't cope with the cataloguing systems and things. So then she'd gone into taking on some voluntary counselling work. And then she talked about in the interview, she said, I had to give that up. She said, I kept mixing up people's stories. I can imagine that's a bit of a problem as a counsellor, actually. So the way she told the story of her later years, and this is the lady in her 60s, so she's not all that old, was one of having to kind of give up activities and occupations and replacing it with another that then she had lost the ability to do and move on to another one. And her daughter, Sarah, was very aware of how her mother felt bereft of purposeful activity. And Sarah, her daughter, she said, I leave her grandchildren, Sarah's children, with her because, for one, it alleviates the fact that she feels useless. And it wasn't without some anxiety that Sarah left her own children with her mother. And she kind of hoped that they wouldn't, in her terms, play up and give her mother a hard time. But she was doing it because she recognised that her mother needed to have a sense of purpose in her activities. And people talked as well about their changing social roles. So Martin, the gentleman who organised a lot for his large body of friends, said, I used to do all the work for holidays with his friends, but it's all had to turn it over to her, his wife, you see, who's really good. I think she's far better than me, actually, I ever was. So I'm saying that in his words and the way he spoke. But he'd had to relinquish something that had been a very important part of what he valued in his life. And going out. So the importance of going out, of leaving the home temporarily, the importance of going out in terms of maintaining identity. So here's Mary. I miss doing things most women do, go shopping. Now and again, I'll sneak out. I don't tell Peter because he'll go off it. Don't know how well that translates from the northeast of England to the rest to Ireland, but basically he wouldn't be very pleased with her. I'm not actually sure that at the time of her interview she was physically able to go sneaking out anywhere, but this was her perception, that she was having to do things behind his back to be covert about what she was wanting to do. And Jane, quite an interesting situation. This is the couple who lived in a very remote part of Wales, and her husband was driving, and his wife Jane said, "Oh, I think it would kill him if they took away the driving. Not kill him, but I think that would be terrible. I think he'd deteriorate if he couldn't drive." And interestingly, when we spoke to the staff, the community psychiatric team, they said, oh yeah, we know he drives. And it was interesting how they kind of minimised the risk, because they said, well, actually they'd be really, really stuck up the side of a mountain with no access to anywhere if he stopped driving. And then they went on and said, yeah, well, we all find it a bit hard and challenging driving up the M6, don't we? So, well, you know, it's kind of, they kind of were diminishing the risk, perhaps as a way of kind of making it be okay that they were tacitly allowing him to carry on driving when everybody was beginning to have a bit of a question mark over this. Independence, going out alone, not alone. Jack talked about how he was told he shouldn't drive. He, as well as organising the holidays with his friends, he also was an amateur actor, and he organised the bus to take people around acting and things. It was a big deal to him to lose his driving. And the difficulty of maintaining friendships. So Sarah talking about her mother at the end there, saying she just refuses to go anywhere without anybody. So she's very isolated, because equally she wasn't prepared to accept anybody supporting her to go out and things. The areas all link together, if you like. So what does this tell us about everyday life? Everyday life becomes unstable. It's an unstable structure, and there's competing social expectations of independent adulthood and dementia, and how we position the dementia, how we position independent adulthood. And they're in competition within any one individual and across the kind of people they're immediately interacting with. But what we did feel, what was very evident, that each member of that triad was trying to bridge over to each other, were trying to enable each other and recognise what each other's needs were. Sometimes we would look at that and go, or, you know, I'm glad I'm not married because Peter sounds like he's kind of so in there observing her all the time and things. But he was trying to keep her safe. So, you know, it's like, how do you work with that? What's the purposes of these micro negotiations that are going on all the time for people in their lives? One, it's about sense making. It's about trying to maintain activities, trying to maintain responsibility for aspects of your life that and do things that are, confer sense to your life. So people trying to hold on to, trying to maintain and prevent other people taking away from them things that mean that their lives still have a sense to them, for them. It's about maintaining identity and about holding on to and not letting other people forefront the dementia rather than forefront them as a person. About claiming and relinquishing decision making and about creating purpose. But I would also argue creating purposelessness. And I've used that expression, purposelessness, creating purposelessness, once in a paper that I submitted. And one of the referees came back and said, well, I don't understand that. Why would anyone want to create purposelessness? I just thought, well, actually, if you're somebody with dementia, that happens all the time. People are very busy trying to create purposelessness in your life. It's an absolutely really critical concept. So everyday life with dementia is a very dynamic thing in which the person with dementia, the family, the practitioners are constantly trying to amplify and diminish, attenuate risk constructions, risk assessment, risk management. Why is this important? Well, we know from many studies, and I've cited John Bond's work here, that a diagnosis of dementia can lead to professional judgments about lack of insight, can lead to depersonalization, can lead to loss of independence, irrespective of the probability of risk of an untoward event happening. So people jump in there very quickly, exactly as Professor Sabat has just been illustrating to us. People with dementia are often not given a chance because the dementia is in front of everybody. So I kind of link these issues through to issues around quality of life or physical safety, and talk about silent harms and how if we forefront dementia, if we forefront the imperative to keep somebody physically safe, we are very often creating harms to people that are about diminishing their sense of who they are, what they're about, what their role in society is. I'm actually doing some work with some police forces at the moment around about people who go missing, and covering quite a broad spectrum of that, but including what are the strategies that people use at present to avoid going missing. So what, for example, if you've got a daughter who's caring for a parent and they need to go shopping, they're worried that their mother might walk out of the house, wander, whatever the term is, you know, and so, well, let's just lock the house so they can't get out, you know, so we can forefront physical safety and it can result in silent harms. Mike Titterton, who I've been fortunate enough to do quite a bit of work with as well, has talked about the problem of attending only to physical safety. It ignores other needs. It denies often the right to choice and self-determination, a loss of sense of self-esteem and respect. It's a form of institutionalization, and at its worst can lead to the abuse of vulnerable people. So arguably, the danger is not that we take too many risks with people, but we don't take enough risks. But we have to think about that. So let me just take a moment just to kind of say, but how do we do that? Because I know how scary that can be to think that you're taking risks, and particularly if you're working in health and social care services, can feel very risk averse sometimes. So it's probably the most complex part of professional practice, I think. but it's one way where getting it right and accommodating, taking a few risks, because that's what gives us all quality of life, can make such a big difference to people with dementia. So some of the key things, and this is a different part of that same study, actually, one of the different work packages within it, where we worked with staff around some of the key issues that they felt they experienced. And so they talked about how hard it is to balance independence and autonomy with exposure to potential harms, whether it's falling, driving, whatever it might be. They talked about how maintaining safety and protecting from harm, physical harm mostly, is, in the view of many staff, insufficient, but they often feel constrained by organisational expectations of the way they conduct their work. And the dilemmas faced by practitioners and service managers in risk assessment for people with dementia are very complex, but have an enormous effect on the way people can lead their lives. So some of the things that staff feel is that in making judgments, they are themselves being judged. That making judgments for fear of being judged is something that's a really difficult thing to do. They're working with multiple views of the right thing to do, and it's really hard to know how to gather and interpret information to inform those judgments. And especially when you're working against the kind of the default position of dementia first, as we've heard this morning already, the default position, sadly, is, oh, here's somebody with dementia, not here's somebody who happens to have dementia, but they're also everything else that they are in life. So the dementia is often so forefronted. How do you gather that other information? And how do you keep the person central to person-centered care? How do you work with conflicts between different people working in a multidisciplinary team? And often a problem being pushed around a system. So, you know, it's a medical problem, it's a social problem, a cultural problem, it's your problem, oh, it's the family. You know, where do you go with that? So things get pushed around a system because they're really in such complex areas to work with. Andy Alaszewski has a very, I think, useful way of thinking about how we position ourselves. And by we, I don't mean only health and social care practitioners, but also family members and things. What kind of role do we take? If we think of risk as a hazard, then we become a hazard manager. We're moving all the rugs so they don't get tripped over or whatever it might be. If we think of risk and the ability to take risks, however much support is needed to enable that to happen, if we see risk as potentially empowering, then we become a facilitator of that. And I think we've heard some lovely examples today as well about how some of the work that you're taking forward in Ireland is actually positioning that risk facilitation. How do we enable this person to get out and go swimming, to get out and do the shopping, whatever it might be? But how do we facilitate that and enable it? If we see risk as a dilemma, then the practitioner, or perhaps the family member, perhaps the person with dementia, is seen as the negotiator. How do they negotiate through all those dilemmas? So if we're looking to support quality of life through positive risk-taking, then we need to think about enabling people to manage uncertainty. We will never create so much certainty about anything that there is no exposure to untoward events. So we need to make sure people can manage uncertainty. We need to have really effective advocacy of the views of the person who has dementia themselves, and that for them to be involved in decisions about risk taking or risk avoiding. We need to ensure that assessment includes the psychosocial aspects and emotional aspects of well-being, not only the physical safety, and that it builds on existing coping strategies and existing strategies of resilience. And that requires us to have phenomenally good communication within services, between services, with the family, with the person who has dementia. So one of the things that came out of that project was developing a framework of risk assessment and management that's very simple, talks about identifying risks in the life context, in the context of personal biography of the person, and in the context of their everyday life. That talks about identifying the different risk perspectives. So Peter and Mary had very different positions that they took on that, and that caused those tensions, those contested territories. So what is everybody's perspective? Let's know that and get it out on the table. Let's truly think about how likely are some things to happen. How often, really, does somebody wander out of their home and get knocked down? How often, really, does somebody blow the house up? Let's look at those risks and weigh the implications of them. And let's look at and build on the current and past strategies that everybody has developed for managing risk. And Manthorpe and Moriarty have done a really nice heat map, I think these are called, because basically they're saying if the risk of harm is very low and it makes a big difference to quality of life, carry on doing it. Why stop just because somebody now is known to have dementia? Maybe there's something, though, that does carry a significant risk of harm were it to happen, but it actually is really important to that person's quality of life, in which case we need to really balance that carefully, but maybe substitute. So maybe, you know, if cooking is now living out of packets, maybe we can get those cooking things out and sit down and make a cake together. And it's only if things actually add very little to quality of life and carry a very high risk of likelihood and an outcome being harmful that we should stop things. So I think this is a device that helps us minimize what gets stopped in life. So just to draw that to a conclusion, I would argue that these areas of contested territories are actually really purposeful, they're very dynamic, and it's through these micro negotiations that the person with dementia, the family, any practitioners are involved, are trying to moderate each other's perceptions of risk and to explain and reconcile some of those changing family dynamics. Thank you.